Hi, good to have you with us. From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore. And welcome to our first episode for 2017.
We're really looking forward to sharing some great conversations with you this year. And we're kicking off with Alistair McGrath. This is a guy who I've heard reads something like 3 books a day.
Yes, someone told me that he writes lectures or book chapters in his head while he's doing things like standing in line for food for 5 minutes. You know, he uses every scrap of his time. And he has written a lot of books about a lot of things.
Certainly you can say that there have been periods of conflict or issues of conflict in science and faith, but there have also been issues of synergy, where there have been resonance between the two. All we can say really is these are complicated, they're interesting, but this incredibly simplistic idea that science necessarily is against faith or vice versa is simply unsustainable.
Alistair McGrath is the Chair of Science and Religion at the University of Oxford. His job is all about the dialogue between science and religion, two areas that many people imagine have nothing to say to each other, or at least nothing positive or productive.
McGrath's research and his personal experience have shown something quite different, though. He even says it was science that brought him to faith.
Yes, we're going to hear that story a bit later. I got to interview him at his college in Oxford last year. But first, he gave me a bit of a whistle-stop tour of the history and philosophy of science. And there aren't many people in the world who know this story better.
We don't fully understand why what we sometimes call the scientific revolution happened in the way it did, or indeed in the place that it did.
So that we're not just tossing around terms like scientific revolution here. This is the dramatic shift that happens in Europe starting from the 16th century. Think Copernicus and the idea that the Earth goes around the sun, up to Isaac Newton's famous 3 laws of motion.
What we can begin to do is say there are a number of factors that may have played into this. One of them might well be the Christian doctrine of creation, which talks about an ordered universe whose structure is discernible to the human mind, or if you like, that there's a rationally transparent universe that the human mind can grasp, and at the same time giving us motivations for doing that, and in effect to study God's creation is to give you an amplification of your vision of God himself.
Of course, the picture many of us have in our heads of the scientific revolution and the Christian church is quite different to that. And McGrath says, yes, there's definitely some basis for this.
Like any institution in a position of power, the church felt threatened by some of these developments. Scientists were people over whom it had no control. I think, therefore, it tried to direct, it tried to, in effect, influence the course of the scientific revolution. And I think that was a mistake.
There's 2 sides to this story, in other words.
There's a Christian faith itself, which gives you this wonderful, if you like, roadmap, this wonderful way of looking at things, which says, look, investigate this. By looking at nature, you are discerning more about the mind and the beauty of God. Then on the other hand, we have the church, the institution. And sometimes the church was very resistant to this kind of thinking. So we have this paradox that at one level, Christianity is saying, investigate, rejoice. On the other, the church, the institution, is saying, hey, slow down, we're not sure about this. And so it's this dialectic between the ideas and the institution. I often wonder what would happen if we had Christianity but no church. Might the scientific revolution have moved even more quickly? But here's a key point. You cannot say that the church is to be equated with Christianity.
This question of organized religion, of the church as an institution, is one that bothers a lot of people. McGrath says that there are good reasons for keeping institutions like the church, but he has given the problem a lot of thought.
I think the reality is that power corrupts and distorts anything. And when Christianity became powerful in Rome, in Western Europe, elsewhere, inevitably the pressures of establishment began to distort it. And many of us would say that there's nothing wrong with the church as an institution. The danger is when the church becomes caught up in a political dynamic which corrupts everything. I think one of the questions that occurs to me is whether Christianity could be disengaged from power structures so it's free to serve, to influence with a vision of good and service, rather than being entangled with issues about the identity of the state and social influence. That seems to me to be a real problem for Christianity, But I have to say, it's a real problem for any religious faith, for any political philosophy, which becomes entangled with power.
Moral of the story, then, for science and religion?
So we have this very interesting situation that there is no warfare between science and faith, but there is a complex dynamic of power between the church and science. And that seems to me to be something that we now understand far better than we did at the time. If history replayed itself, I think we might get this one right this time round.
But before we get a lot of constructive comments asking, but what about Darwin and evolution? I did ask McGrath about this. Haven't Christians opposed Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection since it was first published in 1859?
If there is a tension between Christianity and Darwinism, that was not really seen at the time in the 1850s, 1860s. It really emerged in the 1920s in North America when the movement that we sometimes call Protestant fundamentalism began to develop.
So this is interesting. Christian hostility to Darwinism was really the product of a specific place and time.
If we go back to England in the 1860s, we see a very different picture. The Church of England thought, look, this makes sense. But we have people like, for example, Charles Kingsley at Westminster Abbey, or indeed Samuel Wilberforce, Bishop of Oxford, both saying, look, this makes sense. The science seems to resonate with the way in which we read our Bibles. And Frederick Temple, who later became Archbishop of Canterbury, preached a very famous sermon in which he said that Darwin had simply helped us to see that God, in effect, enabled nature to make itself, in effect, transferring a certain degree of autonomy to the created order. So we need, I think, to be very careful not to read the original location of Darwinism in the light, for example, of the fundamentalist controversies of the 1920s. It's very different.
It's worth noting, too, that all these Christian leaders and scholars accepting or even embracing the theory of evolution, they weren't just hastily adapting Christian ideas about the Bible and creation to suit the times. McGrath points out that if we go way back to Augustine in the 5th century, one of the biggest thinkers in the Christian tradition, he interprets the Bible's creation accounts as a gradual process, not a one-off act.
He was saying, look, the obvious way of reading Genesis is that God initiates the world in an instant and then it begins to develop, to evolve according to the way God wants it to. So in effect, what we see now is not the original created order, but a development of that. It in effect is something that changes over time. And that's a theme we find in Scripture itself. It talks about the earth bringing things forth. Now you can see immediately that opens up various ways of understanding things that are immensely conducive to the theory of evolution. What I would say to everyone listening to this is that, look, there could be a tension between Christianity and evolution, but there doesn't have to be. The Christian tradition is very open to this. The biblical narrative itself is open to this. It does not involve the pulling out of a rug from under something. It's simply the reassessment of one element in the big picture, which many earlier Christian writers saw in a very different way in any case.
We at CPX have spoken to quite a few leading academics about this science-faith conflict over the years, and they all say the same thing, that in academic circles, it's essentially a myth. It's just not how historians talk about that relationship anymore.
I think it's very important we realise that scholarship has simply moved away from this idea of some conflict between science and faith. There is science, there's faith, and actually each different generation has its own understanding of what science is, what religion is. So it's a very complicated picture. That's why it's so rich and exciting. And I think we just need to set these stereotypes to one side and look at these things properly.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're hearing from Alistair McGrath, Chair of Science and Religion at the University of Oxford. He's been guiding us through some of the history, but we were also interested to hear about his personal history, how science and faith have interacted for him.
Well, my own personal journey is that of a gradual movement from atheism to Christianity. And I think that one of the reasons I moved away from my early atheism was my realization that just it was just too simple. That actually it failed to do justice to the complexity of life. It was like what C.S. Lewis once called a glib and shallow rationalism, which actually failed to engage life's complexity. And life is so complicated, you just cannot live with a simplistic philosophy which portrays everything as being black or white and fails to realize that real life is multiple shades of gray. I think one of my main concerns in transitioning from atheism to Christianity was my growing realization that atheism was not generative. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. And it means that it doesn't, in effect, make you excited. It doesn't make you say, here's a new way of seeing things. And look, it makes so much sense. It seemed to be dull, derivative, and unexciting. Christianity gave me a new way of seeing things, which genuinely excited me. Now, let me emphasize, in moving from atheism to Christianity, I don't rubbish atheism. Only some fool would rubbish an alternative viewpoint. It usually means they have not understood it. I respect atheism, but I do believe it to be inadequate. And for me, Christianity, if you like, gives depth to what is otherwise a very simplistic, shallow vision of reality. And we need that depth if we're going to be authentic human beings in this world.
Atheism was inadequate. Christianity provided depth. It's not the kind of shift you might expect from a chemistry undergrad, but McGrath makes it clear that his scientific training actually nudged him towards faith.
I was a scientist myself as a younger man. I studied chemistry at Oxford and ended my doctorate in molecular biophysics. Now, for me, one of the most important things about science is the need to develop theories which adequately engage what we actually observe. And we need to make it absolutely clear, this is not about proving. That's a child's view of science. Science is much more saying, look, there are multiple ways of explaining things. We have to develop criteria which determines what the best theory is. It might be simplicity or elegance or fruitfulness or comprehensiveness. And I find that way of thinking very applicable to Christianity. Christianity is about giving this way of looking at things, which invites you to judge it by how adequately it's able to render the world around us. And so as I reflected that on how Christianity engages what I observe around me, what I experience within me, I found it did far more justice to these things than atheism ever did. So that's why I transitioned. I suppose I could say that actually science brought me to faith. It may surprise some of your listeners who have kind of bought into an older way of thinking, but that's the way it was for me.
So for the former atheist, the scientist, the Oxford scholar, what is faith?
I think when I was an atheist, I assumed faith was simply believing something that was clearly not true and running away from the evidence. But I was very young then, and the world seems very simple to a 16-year-old. Nowadays, I would say something like this. Faith is the irreducible condition of humanity. To live authentic lives, whether you're an atheist or whatever, you have to believe certain things you cannot prove to be true. And therefore, it's not about proving things. It's about saying, here are good reasons for thinking this is right. It's about warranted belief. It's not about, in effect, arbitrary decisions. It's saying, I can't prove this to be true, but everything seems to point in this direction. So for me, faith is a reasonable way of looking at the world, which makes sense of it, recognizing these are such big questions, we cannot hope to prove these things, but nonetheless saying, this makes sense, and perhaps more importantly, this is a way of thinking, a way of seeing things that is to be trusted and is to be inhabited. What I mean by that is the world of faith is a landscape, and you step into it and you say, I could live here. This makes so much sense. It's so engaging, so exciting. You want to go in and be there.
McGrath then doesn't have much time for the new atheist idea that belief in God is ridiculous because his existence can't be scientifically proven. The idea that God is an unevidenced entity.
In other words, it's like some teapot orbiting the planet Jupiter or something like that. There's no evidence for that, so why believe in that? I think it's very interesting to note how this whole idea seems to assume that God is an object within the world. And of course, if you're a religious believer, you'll just say, well, that's not what I believe at all. It's much more about God being the ground of our being, the framework within which the universe is set. It's something much greater than that. It's not so much an object within the world. It is something that gives the world meaning.
This approach to faith and proof is important for other things too.
Let's take this a stage further. I mean, I cannot prove that things called human rights exist. I think anybody listening to me now would say, well, that's a reason for giving up on human rights. I cannot prove what is good. But that doesn't stop me trying to be good, even though I can't prove what the good is. The reality, which I think many people have failed to grasp, is that the human predicament is such that we cannot prove the most ultimate beliefs on which life is based. Whether you're an atheist or a religious person or a politician, you end up believing things you cannot prove. And that's just the way things are. And I have to say I'm very, very skeptical about these simplistic arguments that we only believe what we can prove. It's not right. We can prove shallow truths, but the deep truths which give life meaning and value, they lie beyond proof.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. We've been exploring the old science-religion chestnut with Professor Alistair McGrath. There are few people in the world more qualified to have that conversation with.
If you want to hear more conversations about science and religion or any topic that relates to life and faith, you can listen to all of our podcast episodes on our website, publicchristianity.org. Or on iTunes, just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Every little bit helps us out and it helps other people to find our show.
Next week, we turn from science to art. Join us then.